Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Conversations Season 5. Now, before we begin, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, we are delighted to once again have Sue Moore with us in the studio, Shuswap's favorite gardener and a boundless source of practical information about planting and growing, information which she shares generously with the community in a variety of settings, particularly through the Shuswap Food Action Society and its teaching garden, and now in presentations at Buckerfield's as well as on this show. Sue, it's a great pleasure to have you back with us in Food Conversations
again. Thank you,
Warren. Delightful. It's always a pleasure to have you here. You bring such practical, such down to earth. There we are. We're talking about gardening already. Now, of course, we're a few days into official spring, and the weather is slowly, very slowly drifting towards the time when literally thousands of people in the shoe shop start to get ready to plant and grow. So today we're going to spend some time looking at this magical season and how to make the most of Mother Nature's eternal generosity. So if you're looking out the window at a big field or a small garden patch, flat ground or raised beds, peering into your potting shed or your greenhouse, contemplating at your windowsill or balcony garden, or whether you're a beginner or an experienced gardener, it doesn't matter. This show is for you. So let us compost ourselves and get on with what will be a very informative program. I had to do it, Sue. I had to do it. I had to do a pun. And I did it, and nobody ran out of the studio screaming, so I guess it must have been okay.
That's because you tied us up.
I tied them down. The shackles were on. Nobody could get away. Look, we're going to start from beginning to end the sort of the work of getting ready to garden this summer, if the summer ever comes. As you mentioned on the way to the studio, we're expecting -4 sometime next week, which is not part of the plan, but Mother Nature is always surprising us and keeping us on our toes. So let's begin with talking about the process of planning. Now, I must confess I'm not a very good garden planner, so mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. But planning is important. You've mentioned this before. You don't just walk out to your garden and start sticking things in the ground. You think about a little bit beforehand. So just talk about a little bit about the planning process and getting things worked out in your mind before you actually start to get out in the garden.
Well, I mean, first of all, you need to know why you're growing a garden. Are you growing a garden to feed your family? Do you want a beautiful flower garden that happens to have a couple of vegetables in it, et cetera, et cetera? So you need to know why you're going to grow a garden.
Isn't it wonderful how you can use plants that you eat mixed in with plants you just look at and enjoy the vista of? You can do that. The gardener at the hospital had some wonderful huge kale plants outside the staff entrance, and they look beautiful every time I walk past them, and I'm sure other people felt the same way. They just look beautiful.
And I grow a tomato plant that has a very decorative frilly leaf to it. And the tomatoes are, you know, they're nice. They're adequate. They're red.
Like tomatoes.
They taste like tomatoes. And yet it looks absolutely beautiful, interspersed with your marigolds.
Tell the secret of the name of this plant. Do you remember it?
Silvery fir.
Silvery fir. Good Lord. Not the word we think of, silvery fir, but isn't it wonderful that a tomato plant can look like silvery fir? The world is full of incredible variety. So what do you want to grow? That's the first thing. Now, what about not what you grow, but getting the garden ready?
Well, first of all, if you've never gardened before, you really need to get out there and get your soil prepared. It's very difficult to start first thing in the spring with a lawn and hope to turn it into a vegetable garden if you've never grown anything.
Indeed.
So start with something small. grow something that is that you can supply amendments to from the top, and grow something that you really like to eat, and that will give you some measure of success. So that once you've prepared your soil throughout the year, you'll have more energy for next year.
So you're creating an incentive so that you have at least a modest success the first time around, and that draws you into what is really a fascinating process, watching things come up out of the ground, watching the magic of seeds germinating and producing plants.
Can you imagine that seed, like a tiny, tiny speck of dust, is going to form something that you can eat? It's just, to me, it's just amazing.
It is. It's fascinating. Now, you said, when we were talking about before the show, you said a big seed and a little seed of the same plant, they produce different outcomes, generally speaking. Just talk about that, because some people don't know. They look at seeds. Some plants have very small seeds. Some plants have very large seeds. And some strains of different plants have different size seeds.
There are a few plants that if you use a bigger seed, you will get a more vibrant, slightly earlier crop too. All of the seeds will grow. But, with peas and carrots are the two that come to mind. If you've got a nice, large seed, you're definitely going to get a good, viable crop.
So if you're looking at your soil and you haven't used it before, or you've used it but you want to make sure that it's up to snuff this year, there are ways to test the soil to see what the key ingredients are, the NPK, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. But talk a bit about analyzing your soil to get an idea of what's actually there.
Well, it's a good idea to know what your pH is.
For listeners, that's the acidity or alkalinity of your soil.
Exactly. And the more alkali your soil is, the better results you're going to get. So the average soil would be about 6.5.
Just so anybody knows, the neutral is 7. 0 is extremely acidic. 14 is extremely alkaline.
Mm-hmm. On the farm, our soil was 7.9. And that is normally pretty high. But we produced excellent vegetables, excellent taste, excellent flavor, and I was incredibly happy with it. Mm. The difficulty then is growing a crop that needs a lower pH.
So let's talk a little bit about how you raise or lower pH in just basic ways.
Once you know your soil pH, if you want to raise it, you normally add lime.
Okay.
And something like a dolomite lime, which gives you calcium and magnesium, is a really good choice. If you want to lower your pH, which you may wish to do for potatoes, because they grow best at about 6.2, then you would add gypsum or sulfur.
It's interesting how the pH scale is 14, 0 to 14. And what we're talking about is very small changes in alkalinity and acidity. 6 is just below neutral, 7.4 is just above neutral. And yet, in living things, these slight differences can be extremely important. They affect a lot of processes. And in soil, they affect the plants that grow in them, sometimes to a very significant degree.
Yeah, if the soil is not the correct pH or a decent pH for that particular crop, then the roots of the crop are unable to take up the nutrients. So that's the
which
whole
is pretty
thing.
Important. It's
yes.
Like they can't eat.
Yeah, the soil needs to be a correct pH. It needs to have a certain amount of air in it, like it can't be too compacted. And as they say, Bob's your uncle.
Good old Bob. He's always there when we need him. With respect to finding out the pH, there's different test kits, some very simple, some very complicated. Why don't you just lay out some of the parameters about soil testing kits?
We've never used that many kits because we always had ours tested by a laboratory, which is expensive, and I don't recommend it for
this
the home
garden.
This is
for serious growing for food to sell.
There are some probes that you can put into the ground, and I have never had particularly satisfactory results shared with me by other people. There's also a kind of a $20, $25, $30 range test kit that you can get that you dissolve your soil in the liquid and right. shake it up and give it a test. And
there are there colorimetric tests?
I believe they are.
Yeah. Well, that's not too expensive, $30, to make sure that you're going to have plants growing in your garden.
Exactly. And you know, like, it's really cold right now.
Yes, and it is.
People, you know, like, you get to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a sunny afternoon, and people think to themselves, okay, I'm going to go out and dig the garden. Well, make sure it's not too wet before you dig.
And these kits can determine wetness as well?
No.
That's a separate thing.
Wetness is a really easy one. You don't need any kit whatsoever. You just dig up a little trowel full of soil and squeeze it in your fist. Turn your fist over and bounce your ball of soil. And if it stays in a solid mass, go back in and have a cup of coffee.
Let it dry out.
If it crumbles, then yes, you can go ahead and do what you need to do.
This would be a way to find out how many listeners we have. We'll look around town to see if there's people out in their gardens taking a handful of soil and throwing it in the air. I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Sue Moore, gardener extraordinaire, and our local guru for vegetables and fruits and all sorts of other things. Magical. Now, let's say you have a garden space and you're planning what you're going to put into it. Obviously, the kind of space you have, is it in the shade? Is it exposed to full sun? Does it get a lot of, you know, wind? What are some basic rules that you have to be aware of to make sure that the plots of land that you have available or the indoor spaces you have available are suitable? You have to obviously think about sun, water, and the food in the soil. If I'm not mistaken, those are three basic parameters.
Mm-hmm. The most things you can grow in the sun. Some things you can't grow in the shade. and you know, like, that's always a good thing to start with. And then you can say, okay, I want to grow tomatoes. Well, they will not grow properly in the shade. You really do need the sun. And in a small garden or with a small yard, I've seen people put their tomato plants on something that rolls.
Oh, sure. So you can move into the...
So that you can move it, because you get the morning sun here, the afternoon sun there, and you just go out at, you know, you go out, have your lunch and move your tomato plant.
Have your cup of tea.
Yes.
So you've got some idea about how much sun you have in your garden, the weather is starting to warm up. And you're probably starting to think about seeds or seedlings. Now, let's talk about seeds first, but we're going to talk about seedlings as well, because I must confess I'm a seedling user, and maybe that's laziness, maybe time deficiency or whatever. But seeds are the source of all the growing of things. And seeds, as we said, they're miraculous.
Absolutely. If you start your own seedlings, one is it's cheaper. Two is you don't use as much seed, because when you put seed into the ground, you don't know how much is going to grow. And most home gardeners tend to put their seed in too heavy.
And then have to thin it later.
Which, you know, it's, it's difficult to the heart sometimes to have to discard those beautiful, healthy little, you know, lettuce or carrot plants. And
I can remember pulling absolutely miniature carrots out of the ground and eating them.
Absolutely.
They're very tiny. So you can germinate seeds under some kind of control, say indoors or in a greenhouse or in some kind of protected setting, and see how many are actually going to come up.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's two or three things here that we can talk about. One is if you're growing last year's seed and you're going to put it directly into the ground, it would be a really good idea to just take a piece of paper towel and put a pinch of seed in it and damp it and put it in a Ziploc bag somewhere warm and then check it a few days later to see if the seed is viable.
See if it's actually sprouted.
Absolutely, because there is no point in putting out carrot seed or onion seed or whatever and then having it not come through for you.
So you check the seeds first and you see that some of them are germinating, and then you put the germinated seeds into the
pot? No, you throw those ones away.
Oh, okay.
You throw those ones away.
It's just telling you. It's just information only.
Yeah, it's for information only. If you're doing something like peppers or tomatoes, which has a bigger seed to it, you can, you know, utilize your germination test to actually start your plants. But with carrots or lettuce, it's
not a big deal.
It's not a big deal, yeah.
Yes, they are very tiny seeds. The next step, of course, is to figure out where you're going to start them. Now, some plants are very heat hungry. They don't do well if there's not a lot of heat around. And other plants, it's not so important. What are some useful patterns that you can follow with different kinds of seeds that you're starting
out? Well, one is a seed is a complete package. And it's going to germinate no matter what soil you put it into. It's the next stage that you have the problem with. So what I like to do is I like to germinate my seeds and then transplant them onto a larger pot or container or whatever. And make sure that you have a nice growing medium, that it has some food in it. You can add food if you're to a more sterile mix. You can add fish fertilizer or a pinch of blood meal or bone meal or whatever you need for those particular plants. But just make sure that you have some food in that growing medium. Buy a specialty type of soil from one of your local garden centers.
Like potting soil of some sort.
Yeah.
Any things in potting soil that you think are, for example, sometimes they're sold as organic, sometimes they're not, it doesn't mention what they are or not. Is that something that you tend to pay attention to if you're getting some potting soil?
Well, personally I do because I was a certified organic farmer, but it's more important to pay attention to the consistency of the soil. Mm-hmm. If you're not opposed to your soil fertility being stabilized by some kind of chemical, etc., it's usually a very small amount. But if you buy a soil that is too heavy, then you can overwater. If you overwater, you will find that the roots will start to rot.
Gets very soggy.
So I always look for a soil with at least 20% perlite.
To lighten it up.
Yeah.
So if you have soil in your garden and you're deciding or trying to decide whether you want to buy seeds or use seeds from your own growing of the last season, you made the point that if you're using your own seeds, it's less expensive and you have some idea of what you grew last year and what you got the seeds from. What about commercial seeds? Are there any things that people should know about commercial seeds that are important? I must confess, as we've always grown seeds and plants organically, not certified, but definitely without sort of chemical amendments. So anything to say about the commercial availability of seeds?
Well, they're certainly readily available. There's many, many different companies. If you walk into Buckerfields, you'll find, for instance, Sunshine Seeds. And they're a local company grown by a local farmer, and the money stays in the local economy.
That's wonderful.
Which is great. And they're from Kelowna, so it's really quite local. And the same with West Coast Seeds. And with Pacific Northwest Seeds. They're all relatively local.
Indeed.
But all seeds have to come up to government requirements, and they say what they are on the package, and they should have the germination on the package, and they should have the date they should be sold by.
Right.
But if they have the date that they should be sold by, they could be 10 years old.
Really?
Because the company will germinate the seeds, and if they come up to the specification, the government specifications of germination, then they can sell that seed to be sold within the next, say, 12 months, and that's perfectly okay. You're going to get a perfectly good crop from it. But that is why I suggest that if you have some old seeds sitting in your cupboard, you re-germinate it just to make sure.
Yes.
Because it could be perfectly viable for the next 10 years, or it could not.
Are there any seeds, just as a matter of interest, any seeds that are really well known to be very durable? I'm thinking of places where desert conditions apply most of the time, and then once in a while there's a huge rainstorm and everything sprouts out of the ground like mad and after 15 years of nothing. Are there plants that are more likely to have viable seeds for long periods of time?
Well, first of all, you're talking about adaptability.
Yes.
and those seeds have adapted to that type of situation.
Sure.
But the seeds that I find are really, really viable for the longest are tomatoes.
Really?
I'm growing tomatoes that I saved seeds from in 2003, 2004, and I'm still getting a healthy germination rate from them.
I had visions of the pharaoh's tombs having plants in them and them growing things out of them, but you don't get much germination rate after 2,000 years.
I shouldn't think so. I tend to have a lower long-term germination rate with peas, but the beets, the carrots, the tomatoes, they seem to really thrive. Yeah.
Remind listeners again that I'm talking with Sue Moore, who's a gardener and grower with acres of experience, who's often been on the show and is a fount of information about the growing process. Now, you've got your seeds, you've got your land, your soil is up to snuff, you've checked it out. Let's talk a little bit about kind of plants, because there's important characteristics of plants, and I'm going to use some words and you can help to clarify them. Cross germination or open pollination versus self germination and self pollination, in crossers versus out crossers. So there we are. I've laid out a potpourri. That's to do with something to do with planting indirectly.
Well, now we're talking about saving our own seeds.
Indeed.
from our own crops.
Right.
And there are two basic kinds. There's the inbreeders and the outcrossers. So the inbreeders are your perfect flowers, which will normally, under most circumstances, produce exactly the same crop as you produced the year before.
And they're the self-pollinators?
They're self-pollinators. And they're your peas and your beans, your tomatoes, your peppers, your eggplant. And they will, if you save seed from them, they will normally...
Be true. They'll grow the same thing the next year.
Exactly. The outcrossers need an outside influence to assist them in producing a viable seed. And that can be by wind or by insect. Those are the two main ones.
Do they grow in different ways? They obviously, genetically, one side, the self-germinating or self-propagating, they stick with themselves, and they're sort of a closed circle, socially speaking. And the other ones accept input from various other sources. Do they tend to grow in different ways? Do they bear fruit or whatever the food you're trying to eat from them in different ways?
I've never thought from that perspective.
Yeah.
For instance, a carrot is a biennial, so it will not produce flower and seed in the first year.
Okay.
If it does, if any of the biennials do produce seed in the first year, you really don't want to save that seed, because what you're saving is the genetic trait to not produce the food, but just to produce seed.
Right.
So that's where you need to get rid of those. Then when the carrot, the beet, the cabbage, the various crops that you're trying to produce seed from, they'll produce in the second year. And the only problem there is that if you are only producing crop from two or three roots, you can eventually inbreed a poor quality.
So you have to be alert to varieties of appearances and fruit or...
Yeah, for instance, the standard for growing your own seed, or for the small seed companies, the standard is usually about 100 plants plus. Hmm. Of any one variety.
Hmm.
And that's just not feasible for the home gardener.
Not at all. I'm thinking of the garden that I see around me. They would definitely not tolerate that. Now, we're going to talk about seedlings, because seedlings are for people like me who want to get things going and don't always have enough time to go through the process of germinating what seeds from last year's crops. Talk about seedlings and why they also have a place.
I think that they have a place, especially with a home gardener, a new home gardener, because you can go to one of our local nurseries, you can look at their seedlings and see what they have, and you can say to yourself, well, I only need two kale plants. And probably purchasing two kale plants is a lot more feasible than planting the seeds and trying to produce those plants yourself. What you need to do is you need to know which plants will grow well.
In our geoclimatic zone.
In our climatic zone. And also, if the plants at a nursery are occasionally stressed out.
Indeed.
They've been there too long, they haven't been watered properly, etc., etc. So you need to know which plants are okay to purchase when they're a little stressed.
So as a practical tip, if you go to a garden store, farm and garden store, and you look at the plants and you see one that looks pretty robust and has maybe some beginning flowers, if it's got a flowering crop. If you see something that looks green and growing, is it better to get that? I know it sounds kind of pragmatic to do that, you know, buy something that looks like it's healthy. But towards the end of the season, the growing season, for example, there are often plants left behind that nobody loved up to that point, and they're growing all by themselves in the leftover bin of the farm and garden place. Are they still plants that you can put in the right circumstances and they will produce and gratefully accept your the new environment and how generous the food supply is?
There are a few plants that you can put in really stressed out. Kale is a good example. You can put a kale plant in and
it's tough.
It's tough and it doesn't tend to it's a biennial, so it doesn't tend to flower in the first year. You want it for its leaf, so if you give it a good situation with some, you know, a nice high nitrogen living space.
Biochemical TLC.
You know, feed it a little bit of fish fertilizer. It's going to grow really well for you. With things like tomatoes, you can grow a really stressed out tomato plant, but you have to know how to plant it. Mm. Its roots do not want to go 12 inches down into the soil so that you make it into a nice sturdy plant. It wants to be planted just an inch or so lower than it is in its pot, maybe a couple of inches at the most.
So is that where you bend the roots around?
You bend the stem.
You curve them, yes.
Yes, you allow your plant to lay down on the ground. And if it's laying down, you can cover that laid down stem with a little bit of soil,
right,
and leave the growing tip, a generous growing tip.
Yes.
And it will start standing up and looking towards the sun.
It will say thank you and respond.
It will say thank you, it will respond, and it will grow, and it will give you a crop.
Now let's, because this has been a cool spring, it seems to be, and it seems to be planning to be cool for a little longer, what do we do if we to start things early, to get them growing? We have our own seeds, or we even have seedlings that we picked up at the farm and garden place. How do you advance the season or lengthen the season a little bit? I'm thinking of greenhouses and indoor sprouting and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, if you're planting your seeds straight into the ground, you can enhance the weather by using a piece of rime, which is a cloth that you just lay over the top. If you're just using it for heat retention, you can just pin it down, allowing enough room for your plants to grow, of course, and just put it down on the soil.
You can have sort of hoop structures that go over the, if you have plants in rows, that sort of keep the rime off the plants, that kind of thing.
You can, but if you're just using it for seed germination to just start your cooler seeds, you know, like your carrots, your lettuce, etc., then there's absolutely no need to go to the hoops.
They can handle it, push it up.
But you do need to pin it down, because if the wind comes along and swipes it back and forth across your beds of seeds, you're of course going to ruin your crop.
Traumatize them.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed. Greenhouses. There are increasing numbers of greenhouses in this area, and there's different kinds of things that are sometimes called greenhouses. And you mentioned this when you were talking about things before the show, a seasonal growing tunnel, which isn't really a greenhouse, but does give you some kind of leg up in terms of getting things started a bit earlier.
Well, it gives you a little bit more control.
Yeah.
It prevents the crop being damaged by wind. It prevents it being damaged by overly hard rains. And it increases the heat during the daytime growing time.
Now, this is essentially a sort of a longitudinal structure that's got a cover over top and the ends tend to be open. Is that about how they're normally built?
Well, the ends tend to be closed.
Okay.
But you can open them to allow for airflow. sure. Which, you know, would prevent any kind of disease, any funguses, and would also lower the temperature a little bit during the hottest part of the growing season.
Now, a formal greenhouse, a sealed, well, relatively speaking, sealed building with some kind of transparent cover on it so that light comes in, that's something that is a little bit different from this. It's a little more established structure.
It is, and normally you would have a heat source and possibly even a light source in there, which would allow you to start your plants earlier and to keep them growing longer. I was just been down in the Fraser Valley, and there's acres and acres of greenhouses that I've never seen before.
Are they greenhouses that people grow plants through their entire life cycle, or are they greenhouses where people are just starting plants preparatory to putting them in the field?
Well, the ones in the Fraser Valley grow them through their entire life cycle. Mm. And you can grow them through their entire life cycle. Things like tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, those are the three that really come to mind that need the heat units.
Right. Hmm. Yes, well, there are parts of the world where it's very hard to find a place to grow food that is the kind of food we're accustomed to. But I've seen some interesting experiments in northern communities, you know, close to the Arctic Circle, experiments done in Newfoundland, which imports all its food, which is fairly ridiculous because they're very vulnerable to any interruption of the food delivery system, and growing things through the winter, right through the entire winter with, as you say, an added heat source and a sealed greenhouse type of arrangement.
There's all kinds of experiments going on, even taking an old, insulated container and putting in lights, et cetera, and you can grow food which is fresh and tasty and relatively nutritional. it's only get as much out of your food as you put into it.
Right.
So food grown in a soil situation,
right,
has all those trace minerals and different nutritional aspects.
Can you come close to the same kind of situation in what now has become increasingly popular, which is hydroponic growing, as you can with soil?
Personally, I don't think so. But I'm very interested in the experiments that are going on with fish, where people are raising fish and then pumping the water through something like a hydroponic system. And it has the nutrients from the fish as well as added nutrients to it, which I think is possibly a better situation.
Well, certainly on land, fish farms are becoming hopefully the norm rather than fish farms out at sea, open net cage farming, which is definitely losing its flavor, you might say. Once again, I remind listeners I'm talking with Sue Moore, who's a gardener who has made herself available to the entire community with respect to information about how to grow things, and we're always happy to have her on the show. Now, Sue, let's talk a little bit about plants that require a lot of nutrition and plants that don't or don't even want a lot of nutrition. You used the phrase heavy feeders versus light feeders. Now that's something where preparation of your soil and planning where you put plants can be quite valuable, if not critical.
Absolutely. It's often a good idea to rotate the crops in your garden, not to grow the same crop in the same area year after year. And this is for two or three different reasons. One is because the soil gets depleted of the certain nutrients that one particular crop requires. And another is disease. If you get a disease or a pest or something that is prevalent, then it's a good idea just to move your crop.
Right. Say, sorry, fellows. I have to. You're on your own now.
Yeah, go find your dinner somewhere else.
Go to another restaurant. So that's pretty much a general rule. You don't keep on planting the same thing over and over in the same space?
Correct.
Are there any plants that are exceptions to that rule? Let's say that's the rule. Any plants that like to be in the same spot year after year? I'm thinking only of the potatoes in the potato patch in my backyard, which gave a lot of volunteers leftover little potatoes that kind of popped up the next year.
Well, I don't think, in the annual vegetables, I don't think that there's anything that likes to really be in the same spot year right. after year.
Right.
And with potatoes, you might tend to get a little bit more...
Volunteers?
No, I can't think of the word. It's the scabbiness on the skin.
Oh, sure. I've never had a potato come out of the garden that didn't have some of it on them.
Oh, okay. Then
those little orange-headed white grubs that are sort of semicircular in their body shape that just seem to love eating potatoes. It's their favorite food.
On the farm, we used to, believe it or not, cut up potatoes and put them on skewers and go out and put them on an acre or more of land. We used to put them every few feet. And then after a certain length of time, you would go out and you would pick up those potatoes, put them in a black garbage bag and dispose of them. Because those little worms love them.
you were misleading them.
Absolutely. And they also will cut your lettuces off and various other plants.
Yes. They do enjoy all the gardens I've had introduced.
Wireworms.
Wireworms?
Yeah.
Wireworms, if you're out listening to this show, your numbers come up, so don't get too excited. Start thinking of moving. Now let's talk a little bit about specific plants. Just picking some standard food plants that we all probably have eaten at one time or another. Carrots. What are the essential characteristics of the carrot family that we should know about?
One is they don't like a particularly nutritious soil. If last year your carrots had very, very small roots and very, very large tops, then your soil is too nutritious.
So I guess it would be fair to call carrots light feeders.
Yes.
They don't like too much richness in the soil.
Correct.
What kind of soil? I've heard about sand being mixed in with soil for carrots.
Sand is not necessary unless you have a really heavy soil.
Heavy soil.
So, if you have a heavy clay soil or an incredibly shallow soil, you need to add something. But you also need to know what varieties to plant.
Varieties, obviously, that do well in this geoclimatic area.
Most carrots do well in this area. But if you have an incredibly shallow soil, you're not going to get a 12-inch beautifully tapered carrot.
It hits bottom and bounces back.
Exactly. So you would probably do better to even plant the little ball carrots.
Hmm. Or can you dig the soil deeply and loosen it up and then make something to soften it up or make it less?
Absolutely. If you only have a limited amount of time, or if you are someone who prefers not to turn the soil too frequently,
right.
then digging your carrot bed, the same as digging your parsnip bed, anything with the long
roots.
With the long pointy root, yes, would be the area to concentrate on.
So let's talk about onions. Onions. What do onions like? Besides us liking them, what do they like?
Onions will grow in a moderate soil. They definitely need some nutrition, but they need to form their big onion balls, so they need some nitrogen to get themselves started, but not necessarily as much as your heavy feeders really need.
Let's just stop for a minute and talk about NPK. I had this notion in my mind, which may be right, that N is for the green growth above ground, P is for the roots growing under the ground, and potassium is for the fruit that grows on the plant. Now, that's very simplistic. I hope you will disabuse me of my simplicity.
You know, this is an area where I have to check my little book every time. So
I'm glad to hear that.
You're putting me on the spot here, Warren. But definitely the nitrogen is for the top growth. So things like your cabbages, your broccoli, your kale, actually maybe not quite so much your broccoli, but your cabbages, your kale, your chard, your spinach.
Arugula.
Your arugula, your lettuces. You know, if you want to eat those luscious leaves, then you need a relatively good supply of nitrogen. Ah, with the phosphorus. Yeah, you've got
not
me.
Not so clear cut.
It's not quite so clear cut. The root needs phosphorus. So your root crops would need the phosphorus.
Look, you've said enough already, because if it does help the roots, that is something that accords with the sort of very superficial analysis that has taken place in my mind.
Without going into NPK, which I mean still confuses me, it's also to go into things like, okay, if I want to improve my leaves, I will use blood meal or fish fertilizer.
Lots of protein.
If I want to improve my fruit and my roots, I will use lots of bone meal or seaweed fertilizer. And that's even more simplistic.
But you know, though, all those fertilizers are wonderful because they're complex. They're not just potassium or nitrogen or phosphorus. They are complex biological mixtures and compounds that probably add a whole bunch of stuff to the soil that we're not fully aware of, but is, as far as the plants are concerned, it's like having dessert every day.
Exactly, which is why I really like the organic fertilizers rather than the commercial fertilizers.
Yeah, the pure chemical potash.
Because all you're putting on then is nitrogen.
Yeah, that's right. So we've got our onions and our carrots. I'm thinking what would go in a nice vegetable stew. How about we could put some tomatoes, also known as tomatoes. In my family I grew up, it was tomatoes. And I think there was some social discord in the community calling them tomatoes. I had to explain that I really meant tomatoes for them. Anyway, that plant. Any thoughts about the general habits and likes of tomatoes?
Well, there's two basic, it was tomatoes where I used to come from. But anyway, there's two basic kinds. There's your bush tomato, which is your determinate. And then there's the one that you grew up, the stakes, which is your indeterminate. So indeterminate will go forever all the way up your stake.
Keep on producing.
Whereas your determinate will stay down on the ground.
Meaning you have to stake it? Or you don't have to?
You don't have to stake it.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a good idea to put a tomato cage around it or a little bit of straw underneath it, you know, to keep the tomatoes up off the ground. But on the farm, that's all we used to grow, staking.
It was a long, tedious business.
And we used to get excellent tomatoes.
Hmm. Now, there's another member of the nightshade family, which I'm particularly fond of. So, listeners, you'll have to bear with us. I'm thinking about eggplants.
Ah, aubergines.
Aubergines, yes.
Yes, they again. You know, you don't. A lot of people think that you need two plants of this and two plants of that so that they will cross-pollinate. And no, you don't. You only need one plant, basically, of anything.
Mm.
And the eggplant, again, it's a heavy feeder. It is the preferred dinner of the Colorado potato beetle.
So if you want to invite the Colorado potato beetle for dinner, that's the plant to put out. But if you don't want the Colorado potato beetle...
Well, eggplant is often used as a trap crop.
Really?
For the potato beetle, just to keep your potatoes growing really well. Hmm. And if you don't have potatoes and eggplant, and you do have Colorado potato beetle, it will infest your tomatoes.
What do you do about the Colorado potato beetle besides putting out your aubergine and your eggplants and having them as trap plants and just staring at them, watching them be consumed?
I've always handpicked them. So again, a long, tedious job, but yeah. We used to do it by the acre down on the farm.
My goodness.
Yes, and when we used to go through early in the season and do that first weeding, that first hand weeding, when you can just kind of ruffle up the soil and the weeds go, and we used to bend the plants over. And then underneath the plants, you would see these nests of orange seeds. And that is your Colorado potato beetle.
Really?
Yeah.
So and what would you do then?
Well, you just squish them.
Squish them. Sounds like, I like that thought.
And once your crop was more mature, you'd go out, you know, around about noon in the sunshine, and you'd have your little container of soapy water, and you would just pick the beetles or knock them yes. from the plants into the
and say goodbye.
So, yes.
Let's talk about we're coming near the end of the show. I want to talk about at least one fruit. So why don't we talk about raspberries or strawberries? Your choice.
Raspberries.
Thank you. I like raspberries a lot. All right, raspberries. What do we need to know about raspberries?
We need to know that their roots grow really close to the top of the ground. That they will produce runners.
They do.
So one is to be aware of the runners and to cut them off, give them to your neighbors, replant them, or just allow your patch to grow. But in hot weather, it is a really good idea to mulch your raspberry plants, because otherwise you will dry the soil out, dry the roots out, and too early in the season you'll get no fruit, and later on in the season you won't get healthy canes for the following year.
I remember somebody who'd been growing raspberries during the heat dome, and they were all gone. They all got roasted on the vine, basically. The heat was just too intense for them to manage. And what kind of soil did you say they really... like, are they heavy feeders, light feeders?
Well, they're fruiting, so they like a balanced soil. If you find you're getting lots of leaf and not very much fruit, then you need to add some bone meal or seaweed fertilizer to them.
One, we'll throw in strawberries as a final bonus on the show. Any tips about strawberries? I know you're second fiddle, strawberries to raspberries, but...
Strawberries are... They're so many people's favorite. And people really, really, really want to grow strawberries. And one is, yes, they are a perennial, but they do not produce reliably after about the third year. Hmm. for my very small garden, which I have now, I have a pot, large pot of strawberries. Hmm. And every year I take the runners from that pot and plant a new pot.
So the runners will grow. The original strawberry plant is pretty much done after a season or two.
After a few seasons. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you want three nice pots mm-hmm. of strawberries, you just start one year and then keep. And when that first pot stops producing, you have to say, oh, my God, okay, bye, you're in the compost. And again, give it some bone meal.
Bone meal, compost. I think listeners are probably delighted to hear all the amendments that we've been talking about today that are really superior, and many of them are so complex that we don't really know exactly what's in them. All we know for sure is that they come from Mother Nature and they really help things to grow.
Absolutely.
Sue, once again, it's been delightful. We're going to have you back on the show because there's so many things we haven't talked about yet. But it's always a delight to have you with us and learn more about the world of growing, and which leads to the world of eating.
And I'll try and remember what NPK really does stand for.
Well, you know a lot more about it than I do, and I thought I knew something, and now I know that I don't. So thank you very much. Lovely to have you.